and surpass penetrating and perfect dharma is rarely met with, even 100,000 million kalpas, having it to see and listen to remember and accept. I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
So that was a vow. I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words, the Buddha's words. And so, you know, what practice is living our life with a deep intention or a vow. And at the end of the lecture, you know, we'll chant the vows. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them or awaken with them. I vow to awaken with them. Which means as we awaken, everyone else awakens. And that we see what we awaken to is that the separation that we think exists really doesn't exist. And delusions are inexhaustible, and we vow to end them, to end our delusions. But they're inexhaustible. So I'll talk a little bit about that today, about our karma. What that means, that second vow means that we vow to work with our karma as it arises again and again and again. And then the Dharma gates are endless. I vow to enter them. So the Dharma gates are always presenting themselves through our karma, our karmic reaction to the world around us. That's a Dharma gate. Every time we can feel, we're aware of that contraction. That's a Dharma gate. But every time we see a flower bloom and the breeze on our face, that's a Dharma gate too. Can we enter that and feel at home with everything that supports us? And the Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. Which means, again, to awaken to the reality, maybe the other three vows. So sometimes we don't know as we go through the day, you know, I was going to say to you, what are the Dharma gates that you entered this last week? I think I said that last week. Pay attention to the Dharma gates that you have entered in the last week. And so we think, well, what Dharma gates did I enter? You know, maybe we just think of some very profound, very difficult situation or very profound situation. But no, it happens all the time. 10,000 Dharma gates every day. Every opportunity to let go of a thought that you're constricted around. So I was reading, the Dharma, the Wisdom Journal is a collection of books from the Wisdom publication. At the back they had a little section from Zen Vows for Daily Living by Robert Aitken. So Robert Aitken is one of the seminal Western teachers. He actually was interned in a Japanese concentration camp during the Second World War and met Bly, one of the original translators of kind of Japanese koans, and they met in a concentration camp. And Bly started turning him on to teaching. And so when he was liberated and returned to L.A., he studied with Nyogen Senzaki, one of the very first Japanese teachers that came over from Japan and had a little zendo and did a lot of great translating in the Mumon Kan collection of Zen koans. And then he went on, started a zendo in Hawaii. And so some of his students, Gary Snyder, studied with him. John Tarrant, Pacific Zen in Santa Rosa, and Daniel Tarango right here in Sebastopol are from Robert Aitken's lineage. He's from a lay lineage. I had a couple of exchanges with Robert Aiken, and back in 1970, I was looking for a Dharma center. And I didn't know whether to go to Zen Center. There was only about four back then. Rochester, Zen Center in New York, Zen Center, and Robert Aiken's group in Hawaii. And so I wrote Robert a postcard. I said, "Dear Aiken Roshi, I'm thinking of looking for a permanent place to practice. What do you think about me coming to Hawaii?" Something very terse. So I get back like a 3-page typewritten letter, and just, you know, very meticulously laying out what the practice was and what. But I always remember one of the last paragraphs. She said, "If you have difficulty being around people that have emotional difficulties, you probably shouldn't come." That wasn't the reason I didn't go. I just happened to be in San Francisco, and I stayed at Zen Center, and I didn't have any trouble finding people with emotional difficulties at Zen Center, including my own emotional difficulties, right? But I always was impressed with his thoroughness. And then later, many years later, he was doing a workshop in Green Gulch, or doing a Dharma talk, and I was in the bathroom with him. And I remember after he finished, I mean, he was shaving or something. I remember how meticulous he was about cleaning up the sink around what he, and then cleaned up somebody else's sink. I mean, you know, I thought, here's this revered, you know, patriarch of the Zen lineage out here cleaning sinks. So this is a great teaching. So here are his vows. Very accessible, I think. That's why I wanted to kind of give you an example of vowing. Zen vows for daily life. "Waking up in the morning, I vow with all beings to be ready for sparks of the Dharma from flowers or children or birds." So Dharma gates are boundless, I thought, to enter them. So that's one of the gates, many of the gates that we meet every day. Flowers and children, birds. I vow to not be so preoccupied with the discursive quality of my mind that I cannot be present for how all things advance forward and enlighten me, as Dogen would say. Then the next one. Lathering up to shave, or you could say brushing your teeth, I vow with all beings to cut off my silly vanity and trust what is there underneath. So moving beyond the surface turbulence of our karma into something deeper. Into something deeper. He's vowing to go beyond just his own needs and wants, his own ideas and opinions. Then he's moving into the Zendo. Sounding a bell at the temple, I vow with all beings to ring as true in each moment, mellow, steady, and clear. And I think by temperament, he actually wasn't very mellow. He was pretty highly wired, I think, individual, like many of us, and deeply needed the sitting practice to begin to experience what maybe mellowness could be. To ring true in each moment with each encounter, mellow, steady, and clear. And then the next one, the last one. Kicking a chair in the dark, I vow, when I first read it, I thought maybe he was angry, he kicked a chair, you know, but that wasn't it. It was he's stumbling across the room and he kicks a chair away. Kicking a chair in the dark, I vow with all beings to let the pain and surprise slow me down to this step. So there we are again. Our karma intruding on our life. You know, somebody gets upset with us. We make a mistake. We drop the dish, you know. We stumble. We get attracted to whatever it is, you know. There's a little sharp edge in my bed, and I keep, in the middle of the night when I come back, I keep hitting it with my shin, you know. And so instead of, you know, swearing at it, yet another opportunity, even though I'm half asleep, to wake up. Maybe a good metaphor for most of us, or half asleep most of the time. So I like what Aiken says, and I wanted to give it to you as an example, a very practical example of how we go through the day continually vowing to wake up to the reality of our life. So I wanted to talk a little bit more about that. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. So we don't, you know, many of us sit for many reasons. But one reason we all sit is we want some reprieve. And we get some taste of it. If we didn't, we wouldn't keep coming back. But we want some reprieve from the discursive, chaotic quality of our mind. Some sense of settle. And we can just be with the breath and be with the body and be with our immediate aliveness. But one way to think about meditation, which I'm very grateful to both Uchiyama Roshi, who was a contemporary Suzuki Roshi, who's dead now, who last week I was saying the phrase, open the hand of thought, open. So when we're in some compulsive reactive place, open that hand. Use your meditation practice. Oh, maybe I can open that hand. And his student, Okamura, who has got some great books out. I'm reading his new one, Mountains and Rivers Sutra, which I've lectured on here a couple of times. And Okamura says, think about Zazen as burning up your karma. That's what you're doing. You're burning up your karma. And I like that because it's a very positive way of looking at something that we find troublesome and discouraging, which is the busyness of our mind. So the next time you start to get down on yourself in Zazen practice, in your meditation, your mind is so busy, I just cannot seem to get some reprieve, you know, maybe a couple of minutes sometimes, you know. So instead of getting discouraged that your mind isn't, you're not able to open the hand of thought so easily, think about it, oh, this, I'm just burning up my karma. This is what I'm doing. This is what I'm, that we actually need our thoughts to burn up our karma. How else are you going to burn your karma up, right? The way you're going to burn your karma up is to get your karma activated. So that's why we need other people. You know, that's why we sit with people. One, because we feel your concentration and support. But the other is because if you sit with people long enough, somebody is going to bother you. It's inevitable, right? The person next to you sniffling in a, you know, during a long sitting or whatever it is, that fidgeting or whatever it is, they're going to irritate you. And you're going to get a chance to burn some karma up. You don't see that, right? But I'm reframing this for you very realistically and very positively. This is an opportunity to experience your karma and burn it up. So this is, or you, if you like, you can continue to recapitulate your karma. You can just sit there and stew over the injustice of what just happened to you, which might well be quite unjust. And you can see how you will create more karma. Almost immediately, you'll start to feel worse. You know, you can... But this is not an easy process. I'm saying this jokingly, but this is probably the hardest thing we learn in meditation practice, is this burning up of our karma. Because we want to project it out. We want it to be out there so we don't take responsibility. That's the hardest thing in practice. So, as I've said many times, we should approach practice from two perspectives. One is the absolute and the relative. Zazen gives us an absolute perspective. our mind creates the universe. Our thoughts and feelings come from us, from our karma. It's us. Everything out there is just activating our karma. That's the hardest lesson, I think, to learn in meditation practice. And we never, and delusion, that delusion that it's out, that we're separate or out there, we work with our whole lives. Delusions are inexhaustible. We will never completely exhaust that reactivity we feel. But we can greatly loosen the grip of the tight fist. And we work on in a relative level. Then we get up, hopefully opening the hand of thought, opening the hand of thought, opening our karma, ventilating, like I say, ventilating our karma, right? Get a little, giving a little space. And then when we go out and we actually have to make a decision, you know, do I make the phone call to that person? Do I end the relationship? You know, do I talk to that person about why they're bothering me? We actually have to move into the relative. It is informed by the absolute. And that makes a huge difference. And that's why you see so many cartoons in the New Yorker where the sage is sitting on top of the mountain, right? With this huge perspective of the whole world. You know, how many cartoons have you ever seen like that, right?
Yeah.
Hundreds of cartoons like that. It's an archetype. He's sitting up there. He's climbed up. He's got this great perspective, which is the absolute. And somebody's climbing up with some little problem like, you know, what do I do about, you know, that my plumbing leaks or whatever, whatever's leaking, right? And he's going to, this, he or she is going to give some big perspective on this. So that's what, you know, and it's going to have some sense of humor because usually we're not up there. But Zazen meditation practice helps us have that kind of perspective. So I used to run across a metaphor that was really difficult for me, I don't know, 20 years ago when I first read it. And then over the years, I kept running into it. And I began to feel it more and more, but I still didn't like it. And the metaphor was, be like a stone. Be like wood. And I thought, that is absolutely the opposite of why I'm doing spiritual practice. I do not want to be like a stone or wood. I want to be alive. You know? I want to feel joy and love, and so I resisted. But these were coming from Tang Dynasty, you know, the golden age of Zen, be like a stone. I thought, what do you mean be like a stone? Because I knew and thought that what practice was about coming to your senses. That's what the Buddha said. In the thought, just in the taste, just the taste, in the touch, just the touch, in the seeing, just the seeing, and the heard, just the heard. Don't overlay your karma on top of it. And by doing that, you can come more to your senses. You can be more present. You can be more alive. You can see. You can be ready for the flowers and the children and the birds. That makes sense to me. And still does. And I don't know, how many of you have been to San Francisco, walked down Market Street in the last year? Okay. It's pretty disturbing. I went to try to buy a ticket in BART after some event. I think it was some protest. And people were actually shooting up in BART station. People were smacked out. You know, you walk up and there are people, you know, scary. You know, mumbling to themselves, talking, totally lost in the hand of thought. They have very little capacity to relate beyond the world they're creating for themselves. Same place we are when we miss our exit on the freeway, only you just multiply it by 100, right? Mostly with negative thoughts. I mean, probably all negative thoughts. So those people are not, they haven't come to their senses, right? That's why you say that phrase, come to your senses. Come to your senses, you know? That's what they need to do. They need to come to their senses, come to the immediacy of their life. So what happens? So this is true of all of us, right? We've all experienced this. Somebody does something, and it irritates us. It either irritates us or it really upsets us. So upset that we can spend sometimes years trying to unravel the karma of how to protect ourselves, how to keep this from happening again. And we need to do that. So, you know, on a relative level, we need to do that. But be like a stone. What that means is that our karma is not being activated. One of the examples that a teacher gave, which I was particularly aware of yesterday, because I went to a memorial service for my good friend Jack Camazar, who died at 85. An extraordinary person, born in Israel, an architect and a wonderful sculptor. And he had this capacity, as the Bodhisattva Never Disparaging in the Lotus Sutra, he never saw your weaknesses, he only saw your strength. That's the quote out of the Lotus Sutra. You only see your weaknesses, I only see your strength. I only see your Buddha nature. So no matter who you were, you could go around, we went, every person, he just, like, he would just, first of all, give you a big bear hug, and then it would be like, you are the most important person in the world, and he would just electrify you with that sense, everybody. So everybody thought that they were really special to Jack. Jack was very special because he did that with everybody. But 2 weeks ago, Jack was laying in his living room dead. And we were all going around, often in a kind of Zen thing where you're chanting or you're meditating. It's a little more subdued and solemn. You know, you're kind of sending the person off with your prayers and good wishes. But Jack was more extroverted, and his family didn't want to do it that way. So we did more of a traditional way. We were around the coffin, putting flowers on it, but talking about Jack. You know, well, it was easy because, you know, whatever part of Jack was still there, because we all spoke very positively. But if, you know, I've been to a few where I've had some feelings I've had to work out with this person over my life. So the story about, like, being with a stone, or what Uchiyama Roshi says, be like a dead person. He says, when people are talking to you, in Zazen, be that, not reactive. All you're doing is you're listening, you're being with, but you're practicing not reactivity. You're like a stone, right? This is, you know, this is extraordinarily difficult to do. To not sit there and reprocess the injury. You know, we think, oh, I'm in meditation practice, and that's what I do. This is great. I got 35 minutes to just work through this problem about how this person injured me. And so we go through it again and again and again and again and again and again. And at some point, if you do it long enough, and that's why longer sittings are helpful. If you're only sitting 10 minutes, you're just beginning to burn that karma. But if you sit for 7 days, for example, with this thing, after about the third day of going through this 300 times, you begin to see how much suffering. You're recapitulating your karma. And you decide to go deeper and deeper. And pretty soon you realize, not necessarily pretty soon, this may take weeks, months, years sometimes, with some of these things, depending on your karma, you begin to see that this person is not there. The injury is not there. It's in your mind is where it is. It's coming from your consciousness. You know, before Freud came the idea about the unconscious, it's subconscious, you know, the Buddhism had this wonderful term called the Alaya Vijnana. And the Alaya Vijnana is called the store consciousness. It means that everything that happens, you store it, you know, and that when things happen, it activates what we call these seeds, these karmic impulses. You know, they had this figured out, you know, back in the, you know, the Abhidharma and the concept of the Alaya Vijnana was developed, you know, 200-300 years before Common Era. And so that's what you're doing in sitting. You're burning up this karma. These karmic seeds are coming to light, and you see how you recapitulate, and then you begin to see it's energy, and then you just have to stay with the energy, even though you're trying to put aside the object and the incident, you still stay with the energy in your body, and you just continually kind of burn it up. This is not easy practice. You know, we think our meditation practice should just be all chilled out and nice and calm. No, you're burning up your karma. And if you're lucky, you'll get some reprieve. You know, you'll see that it isn't always that way. It comes and goes, and like grief, it washes over you again. You got another opportunity to burn it up. And so there's a phrase that's used. And the phrase that I like a lot is the true Dharma eye. The true Dharma eye. The true Dharma eye is being able to see your karma, to be able to work with your karma this way, and to see that that's what's happening in your meditation practice. Now, I know you all know that this isn't all it is. It's just some grim task of sitting down and, you know, being inflamed. You know, the first sermon the Buddha ever gave was the flame sermon. And this is what it was. He said the world's inflamed, meaning your state of mind is inflamed, and I'm going to teach you these practices which are going to calm things down. First sermon he ever gave, this is what he's talking about. He's talking about burning up your karma. You could say, you know, sometimes people say, well, Zazen is so pure, it doesn't deal with psychology very much. But it does. This work is extremely psychological. It's going to the very heart, the very depth, the deepest depth of what causes your suffering, which is your own projection, your own sense of ego about how you create your own suffering. Otherwise, you spend your whole life out there adjusting the world out there, which you do need to do. You know, aren't some people going to your house today? And sign, isn't that happening today? Is Anne here?
Yes.
Are we doing that today?
Right.
Some people are going
to.
We'll make a little announcement at the end. But so we're moving from the absolute to the relative. But maybe we're not going to write a postcard and say, you stupid jerk, how could you possibly. We're not going to do that. You know, maybe we're going to say something like, we love you, whatever, we're going to love you however you vote. But please, take care of the planet. I don't know what we're going to say, but we're not going to, you know, we're going to be informed by our meditation practice. We're going to move from the absolute to the relative, informed by the absolute.
Well, the script is written, but it's not necessarily by people who practice.
I know. I'm making problems here in terms of the latitude we have, but that was my own fantasy. So that's the true Dharma eye, is how do we do this? How do we sit with it and be with it? And so you're to be commended that somehow you've learned that there's some sanity to be able to just stew in your own juices for a while. But of course, we also get the reward that occasionally drops away. And it doesn't end. You know, I just finished 2 times a year. Actually, in the summer, I do a retreat with people that Zen priests that I was ordained with. eight of them, and we do 3 days sitting and talking. But then last week, I out two of those guys and the third person, who's now the abbot at Zen Center, Ed Sadazam, who I started practicing back in 70, we go to the mountains and we hike in the mountains. And it was great. There are these people, we've been practicing pretty intensely. And this guy's the abbot of Zen Center. The other guy heads the Branching Streams network of San Francisco Zen Center, little sanghas around the world, of which we're an affiliate. And I was amazed at how often I got irritated. My guy is walking so slow. Why is he? He is not talking to me. Why isn't he talking to me? Doesn't he like me? It was just fascinating, you know? And then we'd sit in the morning and cook for each other and really good feelings. But these little karmic impulses, you know, even with people that have practiced their whole life. So you have to try to have a little bit of a sense of humor around it and see, that's what we're doing. We're doing some serious work here.